Good day, good evening, Atlantic Brücke community, friends of Atlantic Brücke. Thank you for joining today. My name is Franke Ellmann. I'm the head of programs and transatlantic partnerships here at Atlantic Brücke, and I would like to welcome you and our distinguished speakers to this Atlantic Brücke book note, a format that we've been running for quite some time in person as well as virtually. Today, we're very delighted to host a talk with Jeremy Rifkin, president of the Foundation for Economic Trends and a leading expert in the fields of social and economic theory. Mr. Rifkin has published numerous best-selling books, and we're very excited to have him here today with us. And also a warm welcome to our chairman, Sigmar Gabriel. Both of them will be discussing Mr. Rifkin's latest book, The Age of Resilience. And finally, I would like also to introduce our moderator, who is Ms. Ines Pohl, the head of the Washington, D.C. Bureau of Deutsche Welle. And with that, over to you, Ms. Pohl.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Franka. Thank you very much, Jeremy Rifkin. Thank you very much, Sigmar Gabriel, for your time here. I won't waste time because it's crucial. We only have like 1 hour. Jeremy Rifkin, you will talk like 25 minutes or so about your book, and then we jump right into the discussion. And I just ask our viewers, please post your remarks, your questions in the Q&A section. You will find that on your screen because we want to make that a little bit interactive. But Mr. Rifkin, the floor is yours.
Well, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be with you today. Also, a real pleasure to be with my friend Sigmar Gabriel. He has singularly been responsible for helping move Europe and then the rest of the world into this great energy transition to address climate change over all these years. So it's always a pleasure to be with him on any forum. I'm going to start off with the thesis of this book first. I believe that we are seeing the beginning of a long endgame for what we've called the age of progress. I think it's on a deathbed. I believe we're seeing the ascendance of a completely new page in history called the age of resilience. I believe that this is the third great reset of our species in our short history on the planet. With that said, let me start on a somber note. The viruses are going to keep coming. We're going to have more pandemics. And here's the reason why. When my dad was born in 1908, 85% of this planet was still wilderness, wild, no human development. Today, only 25% of the wild planet is still here. And within 40 or 50 years, we may have none left. And so what's happening is there's going to be more pandemics because the viruses are now climate migrants. As the wilderness depletes, they're hitching a ride to animals and getting closer and closer to urban human populations. Then we have real-time climate change. No longer a theory, it's here in real time. I want to explain climate change in 2 minutes because it's never really talked about. Here's what climate change is all about. We have spewed massive amounts of fossil fuels into the atmosphere with the industrial age. And those fossil fuel emissions are blocking the sun's heat from getting back off the planet. So for every 1 degree Celsius that the temperature goes up because of global warming, the atmosphere is actually sucking up 7% more precipitation from the ground. The heat is forcing the precipitation into the clouds. More concentrated precipitation in the clouds and wild, uncontrollable, exponential water events. We're seeing something called atmospheric rivers now across the Pacific, flooding our coasts. We have spring floods across all the continents. We're witnessing summer droughts and heat waves and wildfires over millions of acres of land. And then we have the hurricanes and typhoons. What we're seeing is the hydrological cycle. We are the watery planet. The hydrological cycle is rewilding with climate change, enforcing a complete change in every aspect of life on this earth. So how did we get here? How did this happen? It isn't just about spewing fossil fuels into the atmosphere. This is a longer history. I think in the Western society, at least, it goes way back to the first historical document, the book of Genesis in the Bible. If you recall, the Lord is with Adam and Eve in the garden. and says, do not eat that apple from the tree of knowledge, or I will expel you from the garden. They violated his trust. And he said, I'm going to expel you from paradise. You will have to live by your toil and all those that come after you, but I'll give you a gift. I'll let you have dominion over my entire creation. You shall dominate nature. That mandate in various incarnations all the way through the hydraulic civilization to the industrial age, the age of progress, has continued to move and escalate. And here's what I think is happening right now. There's a big unspoken. There are billions of people in the last 3 years who have become frightened to death. They don't talk about it. It's not much in the media. They're seeing a whole planet that's changing in front of their eyes. The floods, the droughts, the wildfires, and it's destroying ecosystems. It's destroying property. People's lives are being taken. And the big unspoken is they're beginning to realize, all of us, that this planet is much more powerful than we ever imagined. And our species is much smaller and less significant in the future of this planet. This is a change in consciousness that is unprecedented in history. The second thing that I think we need to take a look at is, how did we get here then? And this may be a difficult for us to get a handle on, but my own opinion is that it's not just fossil fuels. It's the entire set of assumptions, the narrative, the worldview, the way we've organized our forms of governance, how we've managed our economies, how we relate to nature, how we approach science and technology, how we educate our kids, how we see selfhood. It's this whole bundle of premises that have gone all the way through at least the age of enlightenment, the age of progress, the industrial age. It's taken us to an extinction event. The problem, we're using these same set of assumptions to try to address the crisis we've created, because we don't have another playbook that we can share that would allow us to do things in a different way. But that's beginning to emerge, I think, as we began to make this shift from a dying age of progress to a rising age of resilience. And I've got to say, I'm guardedly hopeful, guardedly hopeful. I've seen the youngsters, the Gen Zs, the millennials, going out on these massive protests on Fridays, leaving schools, going out in 141 countries, millions of them, time and time again, calling for a climate emergency. And what's so unique about this is these protests are not like any protests we've ever experienced in history. We've had protests all through the time we've been here on this planet. This one's different. This is the first time an entire generation across ideological boundaries, religious boundaries, community boundaries have seen themselves as an endangered species. They are coming together as an endangered species. There's no more of the other. We are one. And they're beginning to see our fellow creatures as part of the evolutionary family. This is the second extraordinary change. First, the planet's bigger than we thought, more powerful, we're less significant. And secondly, we are an endangered species, and together with our fellow creatures. What's really changed here, I think, is that our basic change in the industrial age and the age of progress is the way we've envisioned time and space. These are always crucial to economic paradigm shifts in history. Now, most of us grew up to believe, well, wait a minute, time is just about efficiency. It's always been about how we can be more efficient, how animals and plants could be more efficient, etc. No, no, no. This is a strange anomaly, this temporal orientation, pretty much cued to the industrial age and the age of progress. In all of our history as a species, we have had a temporal value based on adaptivity. Our species, all the other creatures, have myriad biological clocks in their cells, their organs, their tissues, their body. And those biological clocks are adapting moment to moment to the rotation of the Earth every 24 hours. And to seasonal changes as we cross our planet around the sun. That's what temporality is all about. It's adapting to the changes in the lithosphere, the atmosphere, the hydrosphere, and the biosphere. In the industrial age, we came up with this new value, efficiency, and here's what it is. It's extracting greater volumes of the planet's spheres, the hydrosphere, lithosphere, atmosphere, and biosphere, extracting greater volumes at higher speeds and shorter time intervals, efficiency, in order to increase the opulence of our species, but at the expense of the rest of the natural world. And here's a statistic worth knowing. Our little species is less than 1% of the biomass of the Earth, our 8 billion people. You know how much we're using? We're using up 24% of all the net primary production from photosynthesis on this planet today, and 40% to 50% by mid-century. Not workable. So our scientists tell us we're in the sixth extinction event of life on Earth. Doesn't even make the headlines. Most people don't know. The last extinction event was 65 million years ago, and now our scientists are saying we could lose half the species on this planet in the lifetime of our kids. We need to make some fundamental changes quick for a third reset in history. So efficiency is very interesting because it's not only about quickening the speeds and shortening the time intervals. It's also about eliminating the friction. My background is economics, and we were taught lean production, Fordism and lean production. You want to be efficient, meaning don't have too much redundancy. You don't want too big a labor force, just what you need. You don't want to have extra inventory, just what you need. You don't want to have too many logistics, just what you need in order to return your investment to the investors. Now, guess what? COVID hit, and everyone said, where are the masks? Where are the ventilators? Where's the toilet paper? It was lean, but it wasn't resilient. And what I'm trying to get at here is that that nature doesn't work this way. Nature is not efficient. It is not efficient. Nature has to be diverse. The more diverse an ecosystem, the more resilient it is against changing climates. The more monocultured an ecosystem, the more lean it is, the more it's vulnerable to break down and collapse. So there are so many categories of our life and the economy and society that differ from nature. In nature, it's not efficiency, it's adaptivity. In nature, there's no such thing as productivity. It doesn't exist. There's only regenerativity, all right? In nature, there's no such thing as growth. It's only flourishing. So in nature, there's no such thing as monoculturing, it's diversity. It's just a different frame of reference. And the more we have strayed from that frame of reference, the more we have injured the planet we live in and jeopardized our own species in the process. The question then is, where do we go from here? A long time ago, maybe 25 years ago, I began to ask the question, how did the great economic paradigm shifts in history occur? I thought maybe we can get a roadmap and a compass on where we go. And Sigmar remembers this. We worked with the European Union, and I've worked with the last four presidents and the current commission. We began to ask anthropologically, you know, what makes up great economic paradigms? And what we found out is that every great economic paradigm in history, seven or eight of them, shared the same common denominator. And that is three new technologies emerge to create an infrastructure that changes the way we manage day-to-day life. Number one, new communications revolutions. Number two, new sources of energy. Number three, new modes of mobility and logistics. So when communication revolutions come to energy, together with energy revolutions and mobility revolutions, they allow larger numbers of people to come together in more diverse skills as a social organism to communicate, power, and move their day-to-day life. And of course, underneath all of that, you have to have, at least up until the modern age, hydraulic infrastructure to move those waters and sequester that hydrosphere. I'll give you a quick example. Britain in the 19th century, first industrial revolution, communication, steam power, printing, and a telegraph, bringing lots of people together over time and space. The energy revolution, we went from burning trees to mining coal. The mobility revolution, the steam engine. And we put railroads together on tracks. That took us to national markets, nation states, and shareholding corporations to be able to provide the financing for this tremendous centralized infrastructure. 20th century, U.S., second industrial revolution, communication revolution, telephone, Alexander Graham Bell brought everyone together over time and space. The energy revolution, cheap Texas oil. They didn't have to rely only on coal. The mobility revolution was the internal combustion engine, road, rail, water, and air corridors. That took us to globalization, global mediating institutions like the World Bank, the OECD, the IMF, the UN, et cetera. And we know that that second revolution, industrial revolution peaked. We know when it happened. July 2008. Oil hit $147 a barrel on world markets that month. The whole global economy shut down. That was the economic earthquake and the beginning of a long, torturous endgame for the industrial age. The collapse of the financial market 60 days later, that's a Ponzi scheme. That was about mortgage and real estate. Why did this happen? Everything depends on oil. We're realizing that now with Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Our cosmetics, our preservatives, our food additives, our pharmaceutical products, our construction materials, it's endless. So when oil goes over 80 and 90 a barrel, everything else goes up. We are now in the end game of the fossil fuel industrial age and the age of progress that went with it. We are now in the early stages of the age of resilience with a new infrastructure coming in, a third industrial revolution infrastructure. And the communication revolution is the internet, 4.5 billion people connected, a little smartphone in their hand with more power than sent our astronauts to the moon in their hand. Now we have connected the planet with communications, but now a second internet is converging with the communication internet. It is an energy internet. We now have millions and soon hundreds of millions, and within 25 years, much of the human race generating their own solar and wind, where they work, where they live, in their communities. And they're already sharing what they don't need on an increasingly digitized electricity internet, sharing it across time zones, using the same data and analytics to share energy across regions, in the next 10 years, continents, in the next 20 years, under oceans, and across the time zones of the world, a global energy internet. Managed by the same analytics and big data we use for communication. They come together. They're converging with a third internet, mobility and logistics internet, made up of electric and fuel cell transport, again, powered by solar and wind electricity from the energy internet, and using big data and analytics to create autonomous transport, bringing all the three internets together, communication, energy, mobility, and logistics. And then the Internet of Things is connecting us with a brain and nervous system so that we can watch and steward the whole planet if we so choose. That's kind of where we're at this point. But I want to share with you what we have found over the process of these last 25 years, first with the European Union. We've been privileged, as Sigmar knows, to work with Sigmar and folks in the European Union. The new plan is Digital Europe Green Deal. Our team has been privileged also to work with China. And their plan is digital plus the ecological civilization. We spent much time in the last many years with them on bringing together the 13th and 14th five-year plan. And more recently, a new start in the United States. My team was working with Senator Schumer, the majority leader, and did much of the principal infrastructure plan that found its way in the Build Back Better plan. Here's what we learned. It's really interesting. Because our team are not academics, they're companies, they're industries across all the span that are deploying this infrastructure. We began to see that this third industrial revolution infrastructure is the last industrial age infrastructure. And that it's morphing in ways we didn't understand to become the first resilient infrastructure of the age of resilience by the mid-2040s. So I'm going to share with you with a list that our team has been putting together over the years we've seen this. We didn't see any of this at the beginning. We are moving a younger generation is moving from the idea of growth to the idea of flourishing. We see this everywhere. We're moving from finance capital to ecological capital, ESG principles, everywhere. We're moving from productivity to regenerativity. We call it the circular economy. We're moving from hyper-consumption to eco-stewardship. We got a lot of young people out there that are becoming vegans and doing lots of other lifestyle changes. We're moving from negative externalities to circularity, from ownership to access, from seller-buyer markets to provider-user networks, from linear to cybernetic processes. And this is important, from vertically integrated economies of scale, big global companies, to laterally distributed small and medium-sized enterprises, blockchained and cooperatives, and very fluid platforms that can operate very agilely all over the world. We're moving from intellectual property rights to more open source sharing of knowledge. That's happening on a major scale. We are moving from zero-sum games, which I grew up on, to network effects. The more in the network, the more people benefit from the network. We're moving from globalization to glocalization. And finally, the big one, we're moving from geopolitics to biospheropolitics. I believe this war in the Ukraine is the last, hopefully, geopolitical war for the industrial age. We are beginning to see a biosphere politics emerge where we begin to cooperate around the world to share the sun, the wind, and the ecosystems of the earth. This is a pretty big change. I don't know if we'll get there in time. I know that it's here, the age of resilience. It isn't scaling. I know the age of progress is on a death watch, but it's dying slowly. It will really depend on whether we understand the nature of this crisis and we roll up our sleeves as a species and see ourselves as a species that has to work together in new ways. I think that's the basic outline, if you will. But I want to add one more thing before we get into the conversation. We are changing the way we perceive what a human being is. This is an important part of the book, The Age of Resilience. It's the third section. I am now looking out the window at the National Institutes of Health. It's right outside my window, the great scientific body of the United States. They launched a project a few years ago that I want you to all to hear about. It's hopeful. They have launched the Human Biome Project. These are all of our scientists across the disciplines. They're now telling us that a human being is not an autonomous agent. A human being is actually an ecosystem, not a metaphor. We are literally an ecosystem. What does this mean? That we are a semi-permeable membrane, each of us, and we are bringing in parts of the hydrosphere, waters, parts of the lithosphere, the elements, parts of the atmosphere, the oxygen, in our molecules, in our cells and our tissues, where they reside for a moment of time, and then they go somewhere else on the planet. And it turns out our own human body is actually changing moment to moment. A mature human body, it changes all the time. You know, the human skeleton is replaced every 10 years, the whole skeleton. The liver is changed every 365 days. The stomach cells every month. And so what we're beginning to realize is that we are a pattern and a process. Each of us are unique, but we are an ecosystem. Here's where it gets really interesting. Our scientists are telling us we're not alone in our body. We need to hear this. There are millions and trillions of other organisms in our body that we barely know about. It's not just the viruses and the bacteria. It's the protists. It's the fungi. It's the archaea. Over half the cells in the human body do not belong to humans. They belong to these other creatures. And while humans are 20,000 genes in our body, guess what? There are millions of other genes in our body that have nothing to do with our body. We are an ecosystem. This is very hopeful news for a younger generation that we're not alone, that it's not us against the planet. It isn't society and civilization against nature. It isn't nature can be appropriated as simple property and commodified for our own use at the expense of the rest of the planet. This is good news. So I think that what we're beginning to see is the outlines of a completely new frame of reference for how we live on this planet. And I'm hoping in the conversation, we can begin to talk about Sigmar. How does this change our notions of governance? How does it change the way we think about science and technology? How it changes the way we think about education of our kids? How we think about the way we want to live as a species in a planet where we're moving from progress to resilience, and hopefully finding new ways to thrive and flourish and bringing our fellow creatures along with us on the ride.
Thank you, Jeremy Rifkin. I read the book, and I can highly recommend to read it. Why is that? I mean, when one listens to you in the beginning, you think, oh my God, this is really disturbing. All the assumptions we were living on, especially as Germans, like efficiency, so deep, you know, for us. Growth, everything is kind of built on growth. But what I really like about your book, and I think it came out in your little lecture here, we can still do something. It's not too late. And this is something when I would like to bring, or now I would like to bring in Sigmar Gabriel. Sigmar Gabriel, you have been a politician for so long, have been a leader of a very important German a party, the SPD, for many, many years. You've been a foreign minister. You have been a vice chancellor. So what do you make of the book? What kind of political actions should be drawn out of the insights Jeremy Rifkin just shared with us?
First of all, I agree. It's really a terrific book, and it shows all the knowledge of Jeremy, which he got through his long career as political advisor. And before we come to the debate, what could it mean for governments and for politicians? Maybe let me first ask Jeremy something, because I'm a German. I love the idea of efficiency, and I'm still puzzled a bit by Jeremy's concentration on efficiency, because I totally agree, it's difficult to disagree that we are at the end of the age of progress. This kind of progress, which we thought which would bring us to a better life through the first, second, and third industrialization. I totally agree. That's the end, and we see that this brought us close to a catastrophe, not only for human beings but for the whole globe. But when it comes to efficiency, my question is: we discussed, Jeremy, even when we discussed the Green Deal in Europe, not only about renewable energies, we also said that it's necessary to be more efficient in the use of resources in the energy, even in the renewable era. Energies. We thought that we have to be more efficient because we are saving resources and we are making things cheaper. And when I go went to international conferences about climate change or biodiversity, on the official agenda, we always discussed about climate, but I would say under the table, there was an inofficial agenda where people always talked about economic advantages or disadvantages, and especially those which came from the developing world. Sometimes they had in the mind that our idea of sustainability, of climate protection, it's another trick of their old colonial masters to stop their economic development. And we try to argue that changing the course, for example, changing from the coal-fired power plants and from nuclear to renewables, that would be a way to get a better life and also to be more efficient. And if more people would be engaged, more countries, more companies in renewable energies, it would become cheaper. So we try to convince them that efficiency is also something which could make the transition, the green transition, affordable for them and more cheaper for the ordinary citizens. Mm-hmm. So now you are coming and say, no, Sigmar, you didn't understand me during our whole conversation. It's the center of evil to look to the efficiency. So please convince me that I understand your concept of efficiency.
Well, it's such an important point that you've made. So I'm glad you brought it into the conversation. Yes. There is a role for efficiency, but it's a particular type of efficiency called aggregate efficiency, which I've talked about in many of my past books. Aggregate efficiency is simply the ability to look at your inputs and outputs and increase your abilities by reducing your fixed and marginal cost. And so I'll give you an example. We don't operate any different than the rest of nature. In nature, for example, if a lion chases down an antelope and eats it, only about 10 to 20% of the antelope goes into the lion for the next stage. The rest is heat loss. It's the laws of thermodynamics. So aggregate efficiency, the ratio of useful to potential work. So that's a good thing. Where it strays is we then believe that we have to increase the volume of what we take out of nature at quicker speeds, shorter time intervals. That's where the problem comes in. And the good thing about solar and wind is that it forces us to share in the time of the planet and the sun. In other words, when people are harvesting solar and wind, it's not a stored commodity, all right? It changes every day. It takes us from geopolitics to biosphere politics. What got us on this route to an abyss is we went back to a burial ground 350 million years ago, the Carboniferous era, and we dug it up. All those dead remains of animal and plant life in the form of coal, oil, and gas. So we had this huge bounty that we then actually used in 200 years to increase the speed at which we were taking the planet into our species and then at the depletion of the Earth itself. When we move to the solar and wind, we will live on the basis of how the wind blows and the sun shines with us. It also takes us from geopolitics to biosphere politics because we have fought so many wars over fossil fuels. So many millions of people have died. I don't have to remind you when France came in to take that Ruhr Valley, the coal, World War II was inevitable. When America stopped supplying oil to Japan in July of 41 in Southeast Asia to Japan, the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor 4 months later, 5 months later. And now we've got Russia in Ukraine. All right. I think this is the last of the fossil fuel wars. But now that we go from stored sun, fossil fuels, to actually the flow of the sun and the wind, it allows us, yes, we can have a certain kinds of aggregate efficiencies, but we have to also understand that every time we engage with nature, there is an entropic bill. And if you add up the thermodynamics, the entropic bill, it always exceeds whatever short-term benefit you got from the particular good or service that you're using. That's the nature of the planet. My own suspicion is that as we move to the sun and the wind and we move into a climate-changing world with all that comes with it, our population will change. In 1776, we had 780 million people on the Earth at the beginning of the fossil fuel era. Today, we've got, 8 billion? But that's because of the stored sun. I believe we will go down in population over the next two centuries. This is not a long time, 200 years, a couple of generations, back to smaller populations on the planet that will have a what I would call a good quality of life and a resilient life, maybe more Spartan, but more quality and less quantity, and maybe something that can be shared because the sun and the wind can be generated by everybody. That's why your leadership has been important in Germany to this. Everybody's going to be generating sun and wind for sure, not just utility scale, but where people live. And then we will learn to share the planet by sharing the sun and the wind. It forces sharing, and it also undermines the military establishment of the world. Big militaries went hand in hand with protecting fossil fuels. It's all been about that. We don't need them when we're sharing the sun and the wind. It forces us to share across time zones. So I hope that's been helpful, but it was a good point you raised, and there will be some role for efficiency, but within that context.
There are so many aspects we could talk about. I would like to bring in, again, some pragmatic kind of thinking. So when you say wind and solar can be shared by everyone, we still need the infrastructure to bring it from one place to the other. And who by the end of the day then decides, who gets this infrastructure which is needed to really make use of these energy sources? And Sigmar Gabriel, I would like to bring you back in with my first question a little bit. What does this precisely mean for politicians to kind of make this vision of Jeremy Rifkin kind of to reality?
I mean, the first question is if politicians, or do politicians accept that the era of progress is over? And I would say that's the biggest hurdle, because Jeremy Rifkin wants to change the mind of people, which has been organized by minimum 200 years, maybe even longer. But from the very beginning of the industrialization, especially for people like me, social democrats or trade unions, this idea of progress was an equivalent for having a better life. And now we see that maybe on a very short, on a very narrow perspective, life could become better. You can get a new refrigerator, a new car. Maybe you can travel around the globe. But on a mid and long-term perspective, the life of your own children and grandchildren will be disastrous. So the question is, do we accept that this idea of progress, which we have learned through all our political life, that this is over? For a second, how do we really share the richness of the world on the globe? Again, I come back to my experience on the international conferences about environment. The vast majority of the representatives of the developing countries asking us, who will pay the bill for infrastructure, for example, for reduction carbon dioxide, for schooling and others. And if you go back to the last climate conference in Sharm el Sheikh, they agreed theoretically about sharing or raising amount of money to help the developing world to catch up in technologies and climate friendly technologies, but they were not able to say a number and to agree on how to use the money. So the first question is, do we really agree that our traditional idea of progress comes to an end or is ending? And second, are we really willing to share? I mean, my personal perspective to the geopolitical risks of the year 2023 and the following years is that the gap between the global north and the global south is opening again. Mm-hmm. I mean, whatever we are criticizing in the globalization, one thing happened, this gap closed a little bit. Mm-hmm. So even China, they whatever you think about the Chinese government, but they brought out 800 million people from bitter poverty to a middle income. And now again, the gap is widening. I just came back from Tanzania, where of course it's a rich German and we are enjoying the Serengeti and the nature and the life. But we also saw the poverty in the small villages, and even in the bigger towns, and cities. So do we really know that all these billions of people who do not live in the global north, who are not very rich, that the way that we have to invest in their life if we are trying to ask them to follow us on a different mm-hmm. path than we went the last 200 years. What we are trying to explain them is, look, we are rich, but the way we did it, it's not sustainable. So we have to change the path. But they are asking us, but what's about us? You did it in your way and you become a rich country. And now you are asking us to stay poor? Or what do you mean?
Yeah.
So that's the biggest challenge in the international cooperation. And I'm very sad to see that we are spending billions of dollars and euros in a war in Central Europe to stop the Russian aggression. There is a country which is where they destroy everything instead of using the money to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor.
Well, let me say.
Thank you. So to structure that, Sarah, Jeremy, if you like, maybe to structure a little bit, maybe we can first talk a little bit how we can get the conclusion of your book into not only the minds of the politicians, but also kind of in the public discourse, right? Because by the end of the day, politicians are also need the votes from the voters. So maybe we can talk a little bit about that and then about the diversion of the global south and the global north again. Thank you.
All right. Well, let me just do this in the form of some bullets then. All right. Look, the industrial age, the age of progress, here's what's happened. At the end of this age of progress, the industrial age, here's some following statistics. We have 500 global corporations in the Fortune 500. All right. Now, many of those CEOs I taught in the advanced management program at Wharton School for 15 years. And these are nice people, but these 500 companies, they are one third of the GDP of the whole world. They only have 65 million workers out of a workforce of 3.5 billion human beings. And the eight richest people at the top of that pyramid, eight individuals, their combined wealth equals the accumulated wealth of one half the human beings living on earth as I speak to you. There's something wrong here. There's something really wrong. It's true that half of the human race has done much better in the industrial age, all of us in the West. It's also true that 44% of the human race making $5 a day or less, poverty, they're no better off. And in many circumstances, they are much worse off as the actual ecosystems they live in are now being deteriorated en masse. So that's, I think, a reality. I'd go back to what Sigmar was saying earlier. It's really about how do we change our concepts of governance. This is a big deal. We're not going to give up global governing institutions and nation states. We're not going to give up regions and municipalities. But what's become clear, the climate disasters don't give a damn about governing borders. They affect ecosystems. So what we're learning with the floods, the droughts, the wildfires, the heat waves, is that they cross political boundaries. And therefore, there has to be a new extension of government called bioregional governance. We don't give up the rest of the governance, but we extend it so that we begin to steward common ecosystems across our traditional political boundaries. Here's the one place America is ahead. We have two bioregional governances now for 30 years, and they are a model for the rest of the world. One is called the Cascadian bioregion. It's the states in the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Seattle, Idaho, et cetera, and the provinces of Canada, British Columbia, Manitoba, et cetera. And they are actually have a legislative body. They actually deal with their ecosystem as their responsibility bioregionally and the kinds of jobs, how they steward it, how they get along with each other. This is a new form of governance. Now, we have a second one called the Great Lakes Laurentian Bioregion, 30 years in play. The Great Lakes, those eight lakes, are 20% of all the remaining fresh water on the whole planet. Did you hear that? On the whole planet. The eight U.S. states, the two Canadian provinces, are deeply entwined, legislatively, politically, governing that ecosystem. This is a new way to think about politics, that it's not about sovereign territory. Okay, that can be a mechanism, but it's really about how we steward the common ecosystems we are in. The Mediterranean is a common ecosystem, which ought to bring together the countries in Europe on that ecosystem with the countries in the Middle East, et cetera. The only other country that's done bioregional governance, China finally did it a year ago. The ecology ministry, with 1,600 ministries underneath it, moved forward with a formative plan for the ecological civilization, and they've named eight ecoregions. We have to do that in Europe. We have to do that around the world. And when we're engaged with bioregional governance, we need citizens' assemblies. We need each generation to be engaged in their bioregion, their ecosystem for their children, their grandchildren. That's where all the jobs are going to be. Robots, AI, they're not going to be out there monitoring and managing and stewarding ecosystems. It requires too much brain power. And big data and analytics isn't going to tell you about the next unpredictable event, all right? So we need to begin to prepare a generation educationally across academic disciplines with clinical learning to be able to understand that ecology is not an academic discipline, it's the frame of reference for all the other disciplines, and begin to prepare a generation in our school systems for a new way of thinking. And finally, I think this goes to the question you just raised. We got to change our notions about how we approach science. Our approach to science has taken us here. Francis Bacon, we always learn, was the founder of science. And you know what he said? Francis Bacon said, this is his quote, man was not made for the earth. The earth was made for man, right out of the book of Genesis, dominate nature. And so his approach to science, which we all learned in school, is we detach ourselves from nature. Objectively, we analyze it, and then we extract the parts of nature that can be useful for us so that we can have our own opinions. It's always in relationship to us, rarely until recently in relationship to our other creatures in the ecosystems we live in. There is a completely new approach to science emerging in Europe, in America, and China. I have not seen it on any TV show or anywhere, but it's emerging. It's called complex adaptive social ecological systems modeling, CASES, C-A-S-E-S. Scientists are beginning to realize they got to get out of their silos, that every one of their disciplines has something to say, but they have to join clinically the anthropologists, the historians, the physicists, the chemists, the biologists, a whole generation to begin to understand how this planet operates, not so that we can extract it in shorter time intervals, but so we can adapt to it like every other species has done through our history on this planet and learn to flourish rather than grow, learn to be regenerative rather than productive. So there is a new approach to education, clinical learning. There's a new approach to science that we talk about in The Age of Resilience in the book. There's a new approach to governance, bioregional governance. All of this is now there. None of this is theory. This is being deployed, but it's not scale. Last thought about the South versus the North. Well, here's the problem. $11 trillion have flooded out of the fossil fuel complex. It's the biggest bubble in history, stranded assets, exploration rights that'll never be amortized, as Sigmar knows. It's refineries we won't need. It's pipelines that we will have to abandon. So there's $11 trillion that flooded out of fossil fuels. They know we're at the beginning of the end. Solar and wind are the cheapest energies in the world. The market is speaking. There's no way to get around the market. But the problem is I meet with bank CEOs of banks every week and insurance companies and pension funds all year round. You know what they say to me? Where are the scaled projects? We got 11,000 mayors who signed up for the COP, climate change. You go to speak to these mayors and they show you their 10 electric buses, their 5 LEED buildings, and their bike paths. They're all pilots. So we have this huge amount of money. Pension funds are $42 trillion. That's millions of workers' money to be invested. Insurance funds, they certainly want to deal with climate change. They're looking for scale projects. What's hampering us, and Sigmar, I think you know this better than I do, political will. It's political will. It's short-term gains. It's having a press conference that we put an electric bus on the road. We need a younger generation that can think interdisciplinary, can think about the big picture, and can begin to work bioregionally to put in these infrastructures around the world. The money's there. We don't even need government money. And the returns on investment are there. And robots and IA are not going to do all this. We're going to need millions and millions of workers for ecosystem services, for bringing back the soil base of the planet, for reforesting the earth, for managing the waters in a new way, because the hydraulic system based on the big dams, that day is over. We're going to drop. We have to reframe the whole infrastructure of the earth. This will be the biggest employment opportunity in history. It will bring together a new generation of companies. Some of the big global companies will make the transition. Some of them are in this room today, because I looked at the list that we've worked with. But there's also going to be a huge amount of small and medium-sized enterprises, very high tech, in fluid platforms, moving around the world agilely. We're going to bring this new transition in. Can we get there in time? I don't know. I won't be here to see it. But what I'm saying is for a younger generation, we have 3 generations on this planet, younger generations, there is no plan B. I don't know if we'll make it, but if there's another plan out there, I don't know what it is. And I agree with Sigmar. I think we are seeing the end of the age of progress and the way we know it. We're seeing the beginning of the age of resilience. One final thought. When Guterres, the Secretary General, went in front of the climate conference a month ago, you know what he said? He said, we still have to reduce our emissions, which Sigmar and others helped start that bandwagon going. But he said, we need a second narrative as well. And he's called it adaptation and resilience. He just didn't know what it was, if I may say. But he had a kind of an inkling of what it was. All right. So we have to take this idea of resilience, adaptivity and resilience, flush it out. That can't be done by a few people. That has to be done by the human population at large. I'm guardedly hopeful, but we'll see.
So thank you, Jeremy. So you talked on the one hand of awareness, then on political will, and then about the next generation. Maybe Sigmar Gabriel, you can also talk a little, pick up on that. How important is this Gen Z, the climate activists, to bring this awareness to the political table?
I would say, of course, this is the most important movement we have. It's right what Jeremy said. It's not only in the developed world where you find people who are a young generation, which is very much aware about the situation they are confronted with. And of course, that's the opportunity of the digital world, that they can connect each other. they, I would say they are not, of course, the majority. There are many others, but they can raise the awareness, and they are doing this. And then when I'm going to schools or to other places, I urge them not to study politics or sociology. They should study engineering and to think about this idea of resilience. Jeremy, until this evening, I also told them to be more efficient. I'm sorry about that, but I think there is a generation. And there's one example in the book of Jeremy, which really, which I found really interesting. This idea of broadening the democracy. I had a small experience in my hometown, where we decided, when it came to the question how we should organize the public transport and which parts of the city shouldn't be used by cars, only by bicycles or pedestrians. We said, let's do not decide this question in the community council alone. Let ask us all the citizens of our city in a very long process. It needs more than a year, but at the end, we came to an agreement which I surely would say we got much more support than we would have got if it would have been only a community or council decision. And it was better that at the beginning the engineers and the members of the community council thought. So this idea of broadening the democracy, bringing more people in the decision, yes, it makes the process slower. That's true. And one of the problems in my country, when it comes to renewable energies, is that we are too slow. But in a different way, I would say it's faster because we would convince more people, yeah. And that's something which you can scale up to other parts. It's not only for the communal community democracy. You also can use this idea on different in different areas of politicians. That I found very interesting. It's at the end of the book of Jeremy, and that's maybe an example where you can bring more people in. But coming back to your question, I think that raising the awareness and thinking different about the future than we did in the past, that's the most exciting experience which I have when I meet young students in universities or at our high schools.
You know, what you're saying is so important. These citizens' assemblies, you know, there's about 3,000 of them right now. But, you know, in my country, we have citizens' juries. Many countries have them, where people are called up during their lifetime. You know, upwards of 8 million people a year are called up for jury duty. About 1.8 million actually serve. And you got 12 men and women in a jury listening to the most complex criminal and civil cases, and they have to have a unanimous verdict, and it works. So I know that citizens' assemblies will be a good extension of government because we're going to have to go across bioregions. But I would like to end with a very promising note. I think this will be very hopeful for young people, especially. I want to talk about a study done by the Smithsonian Institution, the great museums of Washington, D.C. The Smithsonian Institution went back in a study a few years ago, and they tried to ask the question, how did our species survive? How have we survived hominids for 800,000 years, Homo sapiens, the newest part of our species, for 200,000 years? Here's this spindly little creature, not very strong, on two little legs. How did we survive? The old story that all of us grew up on is, well, the last ice age receded, the end of the Pleistocene, 10,000 years ago, 11,000 years ago. The Holocene emerged, nice weather, good climate, and we settled down. Instead of being foragers and hunters, we became agriculturalists. Then we created hydraulic civilizations, and then all the way to the age of progress, the industrial age. Well, the Smithsonian went back and looked at the geological record, and they found out it isn't what happened that way. It isn't just nice weather showed up and we got out of the trees, walked out of the forest, and went into the savannah. It turns out that the 800,000 years of hominid evolution were the most dramatic changes in climate in Earth history. We would have 100,000 years of an ice age, 10,000 years of a thaw. Another 100,000 years of ice age, 10,000 years of thaw. This rotation went on for 800,000 years. It had to do with the shift of the orbit of the planet. So how did our species survive in this unbelievably extreme climate? Their conclusion? We're probably the most adaptive species, with the exception of viruses and bacteria. Why? Big brain, big neocortex, language, so that we can share what we learn and pass it on and build up our knowledge of the world around us. And I would add this, empathy in our neural circuitry. This is a physical thing. We suspect that elephants might have it because they can see themselves in a mirror. We don't know about other creatures, but it's that empathic impulse in our neural circuitry that allows us to experience the other, whether it's a human, an animal, or whatever, as if we're experiencing ourselves. So here's the Smithsonian saying, you know, we're the most adaptive species. Look at the extreme climates we have survived in. The key is the third reset. For most of our history, 95% of the time, we adapted like every other species to nature. That's in our biological blocks. The last 10,000 years, nice climate, we adapted nature simply to one species. We literally exploited all of nature for one species, ours. The third reset, the age of resilience, from the age of progress to the age of resilience, adapt once again to the planet we live in, but not like forager and hunters, sophisticated, use our knowledge, use our cognitive abilities to be able to learn how to be a good steward and always anticipating the changes in this very, very self-organizing planet that's very complex. If we can learn how to adapt to the planet rather than adapting the planet to us, that's what the age of resilience is all about. I'm guardedly hopeful. We have to hope that the younger generation, North and South, will not only see themselves as an endangered species, but also see them as the species responsible for helping to bring the world back so it can thrive and flourish in new ways for generations not yet here. This is an amazing experiment. You know, they put the telegraph, they put the telescope out in the universe recently, and they're finding nothing out there, darkness. This experiment is so beautiful, so wondrous. We're on the verge of losing it. And I'm hoping that this generation will listen up, do their homework, and be involved as activists, as business leaders, as educators, as stewards of their local ecosystems so that we can allow this precious thing called life to flourish in eons to come. I'm hopeful.
Jeremy Rifkin, thank you so much. We only could scratch really this, it's a monument. I mean, you've been working 9 years on this book and one can tell. It's so rich. I also take away that the planet is much more powerful than many, many people think. That should get us thinking. Thank you so much, Sigmar Gabriel. Thank you so much for being a part of this very important discussion. Also the Atlantic Brücke for organizing all our viewers. And again, I highly can recommend this book. It's a good read as well. And it's really worth buying it and reading it and thinking about it and discussing it with your friends and families, because it's the only way I think we will all be able to work on our future. Thank you very much.
It's also published in German.
Right, yeah. Good. Okay, so have a great day and a great evening and talk soon again.
Thank you very much. It's been a real pleasure. Bye. Thank you. Good to see you, Sigmar, as always.